We're back to the Niels Haley Show, Authors Corner segment, Miami Book Fair. I can't believe it's November. November 12th to 19th, the Book Fair. 17th to 19th, the Book Festival. We'll be broadcasting live November 19th. One day this year because of some certain situations, but I'm looking forward to being in my Pittsburgh studio talking to some amazing authors for, I think, the seventh year in a row, but it is the Super Bowl of Books. And my guest continues this conversation, and it's a very interesting theme, to say the least. So I'm excited to welcome to the program author Mark Furtegg. Mark, thanks for calling, and how are you, man?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely, Mark. So let's kind of go into your story, go into specifically enough how you became an author, because it kind of gives us a good understanding of your background, and then we get into Miami Book Fair and all that stuff from there.
Sure. With this book, I'm a lifelong comic book fan, and you know, I kind of wanted to buy this book because I've always been fascinated with comics and World War II and how comics kind of came of age during World War II. And when I went to Amazon to search for it, I found out that it didn't exist. So I decided to write it myself and kind of made an announcement in one of my classes that I teach. I said, hey, I wanted to buy this book. It's not there. I'm going to write it. And a couple years later, here it is.
Interesting. Interesting. So you wanted to write it. Now, what makes you so interested in that period of history, and especially Adolf?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that what a lot of people don't realize about comic books, they trace the beginnings of comic books back to Superman in June of 1938 with Action Comics number one. But comics as we know them really sort of wouldn't exist today without the Second World War. It was the Second World War that made comic books or helped comic books become so pervasive in American culture. Everybody was reading comics back then, way more people than nowadays. Of course, now a lot of people just go to the movies, but back then, kids, grown-ups, servicemen, everybody was reading comic books, and the government realized that they could be a helpful propaganda tool, help to win the war. And I was kind of fascinated to learn all of that stuff, and the book was necessary. I was sort of shocked that it hadn't been done yet. So I'm glad it exists now.
Yeah, I'm absolutely glad it exists now too. So basically, Adolf Hitler saw these comics as a threat to his regime, it sounds like. Am I correct, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, there are some anecdotes that have trickled down through the ages about various Nazi higher-ups who had learned about Superman and kind of derided him as a Jew and a Jewish creation. I don't know so much whether or not Hitler was aware of what was going on, but, you know, he certainly is comic book's first supervillain, and the publishers in America, most of whom in the comic book business were Jewish and were really interested in helping break America's isolationism at the time, certainly put Hitler everywhere, or Hitler surrogates. There was a little period of time there after the war began, but before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, where publishers were actually a little bit nervous about using his real name. They'd change it to Hiller and things like that. There's one story that Martin Goodman, the Timely publisher, what's now Marvel, he had Hitler changed to Hiller at the 11th hour because he was afraid he might get sued for slander. But then, you know, as soon as Pearl Harbor came along and the war began in earnest, everybody dropped all of those concerns. Throughout the early 1940s, comic book's number one supervillain was Adolf Hitler.
Interesting. And so here's where I'm going to say, who is comic book's number one hero, villain now? Who would you say?
I don't know. There's so many. Maybe the Joker sort of continues to reign supreme, but Hitler was kind of unmatched. He bore no rivals throughout the war years.
No, I was going to bring up, is any comic books putting Donald Trump as the villain?
Well, I think, you know what? I think there's going to be a panel about that at the Miami Book Fair, so I'll be in attendance.
That's what I was bringing up. But you got to if you're a comic book writer at that time, Mark, you have to be fear for your life, because honestly, if the war would have gone in a different direction, the Jews in the United States would have been persecuted if Adolf took over the U.S. So they were putting themselves out there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the scarier thing to think about, you know, I don't know if there was ever a scenario by which the Germans would have taken control in the United States. We could have lost the war without anything that extreme happening. But what's a little bit scarier for me to discover was the amount of support in the United States that National Socialism had in the period before Pearl Harbor. So when Joe Simon, and I talk about this in the book, when Joe Simon and Jack Kirby invented Captain America and put him on the cover of Captain America Comics number one, planting one in Hitler's kisser, this was a full year before the United States would get involved in the war. And there were a lot of Americans who didn't like it. There was a great thing on The Atlantic a month or two ago, a pictorial about the German-American Bund. These were Nazi supporters, 20,000 of them, rallying in Madison Square Garden with Charles Lindbergh in the days before the war started. And Simon and Kirby tell stories about being spat upon by passersby on the street as they walked through Midtown Manhattan because they had created Captain America. It's astonishing to think about that today.
No, absolutely, it's astonishing, and it's, but it's also fear. So, what kind of villain? He had to take on some huge things, Mark, in his villain days, Adolf. Right, the way they wrote about him, he probably had some superpowers at times. So, kind of when you're talking about 500 differently restored comics in your book, talking about specifically Adolf Hitler, Adolf in ways. Was more powerful in comics than he was in real life, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, and what I think the path that comic book creators took most often in the ways that they presented Hitler as a villain was as a surrogate for the devil himself. So there's quite a few stories where you know, like in the Scooby-Doo cartoons, they pull the mask off the guy at the end and the whole meddling kids line. In comics, there are so many stories that end up with Hitler being unmasked as Satan himself. So that was the way that comic book creators wanted the American public and their reading public to think about Hitler and his minions.
he's Satan himself. So the surrogates of Adolf were pretty messed up. How much research went into this book?
Quite a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I thought I was an expert on comics, you know, really. As a lifelong comic collector and just spending countless hours in comic book stores and reading comics and reading about comics, I thought I knew what I was talking about. But I think that everybody is naive when they go into a book project. And when you really dig that deeply as you need to write a book, you learn so many things that you didn't know. And so I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to do this. Because it was a real eye opener for me, not so much about comics and not so much about the facts of the war itself, but the relationship between comics and the war and how comics were used to help win the war and sort of mold public opinion, sometimes on the part of the comic book publishing companies, but at other moments when the government itself directly intervened with comic book companies in order to send out a message that they thought that comics were the best format to disseminate.
I definitely think so. And then you're kind of doing that. Did you want to collect these covers as well? Are you a comic collector as well? Did you want to say, I want to get all 500 of them? I know it'd be pretty difficult to do, but is that a goal of yours because you've written this book to say, I might try to collect as many as I can and save up my dollars?
I mean, we'd be talking about $1 zillion. They're really out of reach. And part of the reason why is because so many comic books were destroyed in scrap paper scrap paper drives by the little kids that bought them. There are ads. There are ads in a lot of World War II comics that say, "Hey kids, read this comic and then scrap it in a paper drive." So a lot of that happened, and consequently, very, even though the print runs on many of these issues were over a million, which current comics are not produced in anywhere near that volume, maybe 10% of that for the top selling books. But back then, a million copies of an issue wasn't uncommon, but so many were then scrapped by the very children that bought them. You know, what was interesting for me and what I was able to bring to this is I'm a college graphic design professor by trade, so I was kind of uniquely suited to do this book. I knew about the war, because that's always been, you know, an interest of mine. I knew about the comics because I've always been a collector, but I also had the ability as a designer to kind of acquire these images and then make them look as good as they looked on the day that they hit the spinner racks in the drugstores. So that was sort of my special contribution to this, and I kind of get to have them through the act of restoring them, but financially, so many of the comics that are in the book would in the condition that I'm presenting them would be tens of thousands of dollars. There's probably a couple million dollar covers in there as well.
Well, so that's the fascinating thing. Has any of those people that own them reached out to you about the book at all and say, "I have that copy"?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I reached out to some of them in order to get copies, you know, in order to get the images. But I did seek advice from some well-known collectors to clarify certain points. Comic book artists didn't sign their work very often back in those days, and so you often have to identify the artist through style. And there were some moments where you could identify the style of two or three different artists, and I had to seek out people who are, you know, really focused collectors who might have some history there to help us identify the artists.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it interests me anytime talking about Adolf Hitler. Was anything surprising that really told the truth about Adolf in some of these comics? I'm really pulling a deep question out. But was there anything surprising that was truth about Adolf that you didn't know that was in one as was restored in one of the villains from one of the comics?
No, I don't think so. I think that what you can credit comics with is perhaps getting it right before anybody else did. In those days leading up to even the Nazi invasion of Poland, before the war started at all, not just in Europe, comic books had figured him out in a way that the American public still wasn't so sure. And so, you know, coming back to this issue of Captain America, was really shocking to have a superhero punching out the leader of a foreign country with whom we were not at war, is pretty shocking, and it says a lot about what these publishers and writers and artists were paying attention to and how their radar was maybe a little bit more finely tuned than the public's was by and large.
Absolutely. So where can people pick up the book? And then I want to ask what you're going to be doing participating in Miami, but where can people pick up the book? The fascinating discussion on this Adolf thing. I know lots of people that are fans of comics want to pick this up, but also fans of the mysterious Adolf. But and you know that sometimes books end up, especially comic involvement books, stories end up as movies. As we saw, one of the Miami Book Fair authors we interviewed a couple years ago ended up with a movie on this. And that's My Friend Dahmer. I just had to mention that because that really was impressive to me. I interviewed him at the Miami Book Fair. I'm trying to reach out to them. I can't see the movie in my city, and a friend of mine wants to go with me, and we can't because it's not going to be playing there. I don't know if you heard about that. So we always interestingly look at these authors and say, will their book become a movie? Well, that was pretty cool to see that one of your counterparts from the Miami Book Fair ended up with a movie. Yeah.
It's fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this thing's in bookstores. You can just search "Take That 8 Off" on Amazon, and it comes up, and it's at a good price on Amazon. And I'm sure it'll be available at the book fair through the Fantagraphics website, other places like that.
Do you have any other works coming out, Mark, after this that you wanted to?
You know,
Yeah.
my first book was about movie posters, and I think I'm going to go back to that. My first book was about film noir movie posters, which is, you know, another these sort of post-war mid-century you know, things that I sort of gravitate towards. I think I might I'm going to do a book about Western movie posters next.
Wow, I love that idea. Who would you say your favorite Western is? I'll just finish up with that. What do you think favorite
Oh,
movie
it's
Western character? Yeah.
Red River,
Red.
1948, best Western ever.
What about TV Westerns? Any favorites that you would say you list in?
No, I mean I can get wrapped up in old issues of old episodes of Gunsmoke and Bonanza, but I'm a big John Wayne fan, like everybody else, I guess.
All right. Well, it's good talking to you. Enjoy Miami. Best place we can find information on you, Mark. Where can we go?
Well, you know what? I think the panel that I'm doing at the book fair is on Saturday the 18th at 1 p.m. So if anybody wants to come out and meet me, I would love to do that. I'm in the Living in History panel about historical figures in comics. So I'm excited about that. I don't have a website or anything. My Twitter is at Sin Eater, CinEater. People can connect with me that way.
All right. Well, Mark, it was fascinating having a chat with you. Best of luck. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
Take care, Mark. Thanks. Okay. See you later. Okay. Bye-bye. You're
Yep.
listening to Neil Haley's show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Neil Haley show on the Author's Corner segment, Miami Book Fair style. I can't believe it's November 1st. The 12th and 19th is the book fair. You go to miamibookfair.com for more information. 17th and 19th is the amazing street festival. The weather is horrible here in Pittsburgh. Go to Miami, celebrate the Super Bowl of Books with just amazing authors. miamibookfair.com. We'll be broadcasting live November 19th, only one day. So you got to tune in. I'll be promoting it very big time. It's always great right before we get our turkey, a couple days before we get to celebrate great authors and have a great time. And I have an amazing author on the program as well. So I'm excited to welcome to the program author Susan Rivers, author of The Second Mrs. Hockaday, a novel. Susan, thanks for calling. How are you?
Neil, I'm delighted to be with you today. Thanks for letting me join you on the show.
Absolutely. Let's kind of go right in, delve into specifically enough.
Sure.
Will this be your first time in Miami? Will this be your first time?
Yes. Yeah, actually it is. I can't believe that either, that I haven't yet made it down there on business or for pleasure, but I am so looking forward to this, especially, you know, going down there for the book fair. That's icing on the cake, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh,
So tell me where to
absolutely.
eat.
Yeah, we're in Pittsburgh, and we're going to be broadcasting live from Pittsburgh. And then my co-host will be in. I have two co-hosts, one in Minnesota, and then another one in Tampa. And it's so much fun. We go live the entire day, 2 days every
Yeah,
year. But
that
this
must
year
be a
we're
blast.
shortening it to one. But it's a blast. But we went our first year. We all flew. I flew down, and my co-host drove down from Tampa, and it was a lot of fun. So I hope when my kids are older that I make this an every day, every year thing, the Miami Book Fair, because it's fabulous, and it's fabulous talking to authors. So let's kind of
Oh,
delve into
absolutely.
how you became an author. Tell us your story.
Well, you know, I didn't start out as a novelist. I started out as a dramatist. I was a playwright. I met my husband doing theater in San Francisco some years ago, and that's what I thought I was going to be doing for the rest of my life. But you know, people change and things change, and we ended up moving to the other side of the country, to the Carolinas, when my daughter was still young. And you really need a community when you're doing theater. And I was sort of ready for something very new. We all were, and we got it. the Wake Forest, the little town where we moved to in Wake County, North Carolina, was very different from where we'd been. And we embraced that. And so it affected my writing. You know, I let it. It was a very different world, people. I felt people were different, you know, I don't want to say good ways or bad ways. They were just different. Mostly what I found when we moved to the South was that people did not apologize for who they were. They were authentic. And, you know, you took it or you left it. And mostly I took it because I met so many interesting and unique people. And so, of course, I wanted to try understanding the history of the South so that I could understand the culture and understand, you know, how we've gotten here. And I began to realize as I researched it and, you know, dragged my family around to all the battlefields and house museums and birthplaces and all the interesting places right in the Southeast where we'd never been before, I realized that I hadn't really understood American history before I understood Southern history. So I definitely would say that in the 20 years we've been in the Carolinas, I've, you know, gotten to know a great deal about Southern history. So the funny thing is, when I sat down to write this novel, in the summer of 2014, I wasn't planning to write an historical novel. I had gone to the little library where we lived to look up some research. Excuse me. And I came upon this story, really. It was just a document about an inquest that took place in rural Georgia in 1865 into the death of a baby that was dug up on a farm in Georgia. And the woman who eventually confessed to being the mother of that child was indicted by a grand jury there and went on trial. When I read about this, I was just so gripped by this woman's story. And so I, you know, grabbed everything I had in the library and ran home with this young woman's story already talking to me in my head, and I knew I had then to write her story as a fictionalized sort of every Southern woman's story. That's what the second Mrs. Hockaday ended up being. But the key thing for me was that this woman held on to this secret for her whole life. It became so obvious to me that she did because she couldn't tell her story in 1865. And that's what further compelled me, you know, because I knew I could tell it in 2014, 15, 16, 17, in a way that she could not have. So that's how it came to be. Go ahead, Neil, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to tell you, I said that, so basically, you never planned on being a novelist. It just happened, it sounds like.
Well, no, I shouldn't say that because I had been, I got my MFA, my Master of Fine Arts, in fiction writing from Queen's University in Charlotte in 2007, and I had been working on a novel, a contemporary novel, but you know, there was just so much going on at the time I was working on that book, and I ultimately, you know, I found my agent, but we didn't sell that particular novel. So in 2014, basically what my agent Susan said to me was, you know, I think you're going to be successful with your second novel, not your first. Go off and write that second novel. And I thought, well, that's not happening. But you see, it did, because if you're a writer and if you're meant to write, it happens whether it's convenient or, you know, lucrative or coming at the right time. It doesn't matter. It will, you know, grip you, possess you, and you will have to write whatever that story is. And so for me, it was that I had not planned on writing an historical novel. That's what surprised me. But I think because I had spent these years delving into the South's history and its traumas and its endurance, I was prepared to write that novel. So I think things sort of came together at that point. For Placidia Hockaday's story to be told. And so you know, I felt myself ready to tell that story. That's for sure.
Most definitely. And that's for sure. And it's very compelling to know that how things were not accepted at that compared to they are today. That's
right,
huge.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you could not have a child out of wedlock and be accepted anywhere socially as certainly as a white woman in a, you know, in the planter class, you would have been shunned, you know. So this was certainly a traumatic event for any woman at that time. And I don't want to give away too many secrets of the book, but there are other reasons why Placidia, you know, facing this situation with an unwanted child was really in a terrible situation, really a life and death situation.
And has that helped in dialogue from people that have read the books? Were
mm-hmm.
they surprised in that time period? What was going on in the time period? Or were they more intrigued by what you were able to uncover? So, like, a lot of times, they were not, that your readers really just didn't know that time period, or were they knew some of it from what you're getting feedback, but they just did not know really the entire story?
Right. Well, I think a lot of Southerners certainly know the history. The problem with that can be that they think they know the history so well that they don't need anybody telling it to them. But I found that readers all over the country, I've done, you know, festivals and fairs and book groups all over the country. And I find that it's, you know, that period of history in American history is fascinating to most people, most Americans, I would say, because we're all still trying to, you know, analyze how did we become so conflicted. And we're especially in this kind of political climate in our country, we're asking ourselves that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think the Civil War came up with John Kelly's press conference the other day, you know, the chief of staff. It's something we're asking ourselves now. And I think, you know, people have written to me to tell me that they feel they understand now how we've gotten to that point a little better after reading the book. So I'm appreciative of that. I'm grateful for that. But, like, I'm just trying to understand it like everybody is. But I see so much evidence of how we got there from these primary sources that I research from.
Exactly.
And which I'm researching for on my second novel. You know, letters from people at that time, journals, you know, legal documents. It's so eye-opening.
Okay. All right.
You
so
know, I've
where
sat
is,
in the.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I was going to say that it's eye opening, and you're really getting the research and all the excitement. What are you going to be? Are you going to be on a panel in Miami on the 18th, 19th? Tell us a little bit what you're going to be doing
it's
there.
At this point, it's. I don't think it's definite yet. I know I'm going to be on a group with two other novelists, and our panel on Sunday, the November 19th. At 2:00, it's called Family Dramas. So all of our novels concern events and issues and relationships and families. So I know we will be reading, that much I know. We're all reading from our own novels, and I hope we'll have a chance to discuss, you know, some of the common themes in our novels. But all of them concern, you know, this sort of this ongoing issue of how families shape who we are in the world and what we experience in the world. So I do hope people will come down, you know, and attend the panel and, you know, talk to me afterwards, because I have had the most amazing time meeting readers. That's really been the unforeseen benefit of having a novel published. I knew I thought it would be great to meet people, you know, who read and who could give me their feedback, but I didn't realize how affirming it is, in the sense that I've met so many people who really love literature and who are very
awesome.
Literate people, you know. Yeah, that's been the most amazing thing. And they give me, you know, even when if somebody, you know, has a question or has a certain kind of challenge they want to present to me about the story, it's so helpful as a novelist to hear that from people who've read the book and have ideas about it. So
awesome.
That's been just phenomenal.
Our best place to buy an info on you and purchase your book. Where can we go?
Now, tell me, say that again for me, Neil.
Best place we can find information on you and purchase your book. Where can we go?
Oh, well, please. You can go to Algonquin's website, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And I have a website, which is www.SusanRiversWriter, all lowercase, all one word, SusanRiversWriter.com. And there's all the information you need about the novel and about events and appearances that I'll be making into 2018. And I'm excited
awesome.
About some of the things I'm going to be doing.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks for calling. Enjoy Miami. And thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
I will. Thank you so much, Neil. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Thanks. Okay. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Neil Haley's show. And we'll be back in just a moment.